soul, the human psyche. The marriage number, therefore, represents the failure of mathematics to capture what is most human. We know very well that Plato was a lover of mathematics, but he did not take mathematics and place it at the absolute pinnacle of intellectual endeavors. Mathematics is good, but it's not that good. It's not as good as philosophy, and philosophy is not equivalent to mathematics. What is philosophy? Philosophy is what we find in Plato's Republic. It's conversation. It's dialectic. It's human beings talking to each other using old-fashioned, regular language, not mathematics. So unlike many modern thinkers, Plato relegates mathematics to a subordinate role, good but not the best. I think the joke that's found at 587e in Book 9 is a similar reminder of this point. It would also explain an earlier suggestion I made. The various arguments that Socrates gave us concerning the superiority of philosophical pleasure were not entirely convincing. They were not convincing not because Socrates doesn't believe his conclusion. He does think that philosophy is the best and most pleasurable form of life. But I don't think he believes that there is a single argument, some sort of logical train of thought that in a nutshell could prove the way a mathematical equation might prove its result. The true argument for why philosophy is superior to any other form of life, particularly that of the tyrant, is given in the Republic as a whole, not restricted to just these little three arguments we reviewed earlier. It's the entire Republic in which we gain an understanding of what it means to be a human being. And I believe that is the ultimate teaching of the Republic. It's teaching us what it is to have a soul. At this point, let me mention a very famous problem that scholars have identified in the Republic. An author named David Sachs, you'll find his article in your bibliographies, made this point in an article that has been much discussed. At the end of the Republic, it's unclear whether Socrates is talking about justice in a normal way, or whether he is talking about philosophical justice in the extraordinary sense that he has developed his own ideas through the course of the Republic. The title of David Sachs's article is "The Fallacy of Irrelevance in Plato's Republic." And what he means by irrelevance is, at the very beginning of the Republic, the encounter with Thrasymachus and then with Glaucon that we've discussed at such length, the challenge is to demonstrate that a life of justice is superior to a life of injustice. Now, what Thrasymachus has in mind when he defends the life of injustice is, you might say, ordinary, run-of-the-mill injustice. Robbing people, being unfair, taking advantage of a political system rather than being concerned with the well-being of the whole. It therefore seems that what Socrates is required to do in order to respond adequately to Thrasymachus is defend the life of, let's call it, run-of-the-mill justice. Obeying the law, not robbing people, caring about the community in ways that we would all associate with justice as it is conventionally understood. But of course, as you now know from studying Plato's Republic, the justice that Socrates actually discusses throughout the long, long process that is this dialogue goes far beyond the run-of-the-mill, the ordinary. It seems that what he's discussing and this has been apparent in the way I've developed my own terminology in this course, is philosophical justice. Justice at the end of book four is the harmony of the soul, reason ruling desire with the assistance of spirit. Justice is philosophical harmony of the soul. It's the love of wisdom. Now, I think what some critics might say is, Socrates, you did a really great job explaining that to us, but you never really explained run-of-the-mill justice. Why is that superior? I believe you. I can imagine a critic saying that philosophy is superior to injustice, but why is conventional justice superior to justice? What this suggests is that the real concern of Plato's Republic is philosophy itself. It's actually not justice, at least not justice in the ordinary sense of the term. We have been moving, as you are surely aware, further and further away from the ordinary concerns of an ordinary city. We've been moving, to use the language of the parable of the cave, closer and closer to the sun, leaving the cave behind. I think that's a very deliberate thrust of the Republic. Plato crafts his dialogue precisely to make that point, that the truest concern for justice leads actually away from the city towards philosophy. We'll come back to that point. Let me close this section with a brief look at another extraordinary passage in Book 9. It occurs at 588 C to E. Here, what Socrates does is once again reformulate his tripartite psychology. We've had reason, spirit, and desire. We've had the wisdom lover, the gain lover, the honor lover. And now what Socrates does is construct an image, a picture, which is meant to capture this sense of the tripartite psychology. But as we'll see, it also changes it in a very significant way. What we should do is the following, says Socrates. Let's draw a picture in which a many-headed beast, known as the Hydra, represents desire. We'll have a lion represent spirit, and we'll use a human being to represent reason, the three parts. And we will then enclose all three parts in a human being. And this now is the picture of the human soul. This image, once again, is used in order to make the basic point that Socrates wishes to make, and that is that a life of justice should be pursued. Justice is when reason rules the soul. We now know that reason is the most human of those three beasts inside of a human being. And so, therefore, another way to put Socrates' point is that justice is more human than injustice. The person who would get away with doing injustice becomes more like a beast than a human being. But this is a very odd picture, and you can figure out why if you either draw it or just try to imagine it. Recall, inside a human being is a hydra, the many-headed beast, a lion, and a human being. It's that last item that makes it so peculiar, because if there's a human being inside of a human being, then presumably within that human being is a hydra, a lion, and a human being. And inside that human being, the same three appear. What this suggests is we are on an infinite loop, which is an impossible picture. This is the way some commentators describe this last picture. It's actually a non-picture. It is not a formal structure. It can't be because it infinitely expands. Now, I believe this is entirely deliberate on Plato's part to have Socrates offer this revision of the tripartite psychology. And it goes back to the same theme I've been making for much of this lecture. I mentioned that the failure of the marriage number and the joke about the life of philosophy being so precisely superior to the life of injustice that we can calculate it at 729. The import of those passages was to suggest that mathematics can't capture the human soul. I think the picture at 588c, or rather the non-picture, makes the same point. Compare it to the tripartite psychology of Book 4. Three separate parts. Reason, spirit, desire. They are static, they are rigidly structured, and as we discussed when we were discussing Book 4, it's an incoherent scheme. What made that scheme in Book 4 incoherent is that it required reason to give orders to desire, but desire is so separated from reason that it would be unable to comprehend the orders. In sum, the tripartite scheme of Book 4 is too mathematical. It's too rigid. Each of those three parts is like a separate unit, like a number. Whereas the last image that we find in Book 9, I would suggest, is much more authentically human precisely because it's not so rigid. It's in constant motion. It's in a mode of expansion. And that is much more of an accurate sense of what the human soul really is.
Lecture 21, Book 10, Philosophy versus Poetry.
In this lecture, we're going to concentrate on Book 10, the very last book of Plato's Republic. Before we do so, however, I'd like to take one last look at the very end of Book 9, because Socrates makes a couple of remarks there that I think are worth paying attention to. And I'm referring now to lines 591e to 592b. What Socrates says there is that the job of the philosopher is to look within, and see a regime, a political regime, within himself. He then says that, having looked within, what the philosopher will see is a pattern of a well-organized, just city. Once again, this is within the soul of the philosopher. And then, most strikingly, he says, it doesn't matter if this city that the philosopher glimpses ever actually comes into being. I think these lines are important because they remind us of a theme I've been developing in the last several lectures. The ultimate purpose of Plato's Republic may not be to actually create a blueprint for a city that could actually come into existence. Instead, what I believe the Republic is finally aiming at is precisely what Socrates has just noted at the end of Book 9. An internal city, if I can put it in those terms. The Republic is finally about the human soul. It's not a book that is devoted to the construction or even to the hope of constructing a real city on Earth. I make this point with some emphasis because I'm certain that some of you in learning about Plato's Republic feel a sense of perhaps even revulsion. After all, the regime he constructs in the earlier books seems totalitarian. The family is obliterated, private property is obliterated, all interests are subordinated to the city. I'm suggesting a way of softening your reaction to the Republic, and I'm taking my bearings from these last remarks that Socrates himself makes, suggesting implicitly and nearly explicitly that the real goal of the Republic is to teach us something about ourselves and not to start a political program that we hope to put into actual practice. Now we can turn to Book 10. And this is a very surprising book. This is a book which has given scholars fits for centuries, because we learn upon opening Book 10 that Socrates takes up an issue that we readers would have suspected is long finished. And the issue is poetry. You recall that a huge portion of Books 2 and 3 were devoted to the censorship program, mainly focusing on the censorship of literature. Homer, Hesiod, the tragedians, the comic playwrights, they're all severely regulated in the city Socrates constructs. Having completed that, we might wonder, why in the world does Socrates return to the issue of poetry at the beginning of Book 10? Let me make one point before I go any further. I want to explain this word poetry. When we use it in English, we are referring to a rather narrow genre of literature. The word poetry, as Plato would use it, is much wider in its meaning. It's interesting to look at the etymology of our own word poetry. It comes from the Greek word poiein, which means to make. Poetry, as a Greek would use the word, refers almost to all kinds of artistic production, artistic making in general. It certainly is not restricted to what we in English would call poetry. It refers, most importantly, to all forms of storytelling. When you tell a story, what do? You make it up. That little English phrase is very telling and goes right to the heart of what the word poetry means for Plato. Again, Socrates, as he so often does, surprises us in Book 10, because not only does he revisit the issue of poetry, but he now offers an even more severe criticism of it. If in Books 2 and 3 he censored the poets, if he regulated and restricted their creativity, in Book 10 he comes very close to banishing the poets altogether. This has become a notorious passage in the history of Western culture. It's often pointed to as the best evidence of Plato's hatred of art. We'll investigate that claim in this lecture. Socrates gives two arguments against poetry. The first is usually called by scholars the metaphysical critique of poetry. And in order to make this criticism, Socrates first reviews some of the basic elements of his famous theory of forms. I would refer you here to 596a. Socrates says the following: there is one particular form for each of the particular manys to which we apply the same name. That's a very useful line to review, because it very nicely summarizes much of what we discussed about the theory of forms earlier in this course. Notice the last couple of words, the same name. Remember, as I suggested to you earlier, the theory of forms really takes its bearings, one might almost say gets its inspiration from, language. We have a single word, say the word chair. That single word has a very general meaning. It refers to all the many particular chairs that exist in the world. Every single one of them is different from each other, but they're all united by being a chair. There's a one, the one chair, and then there are the many chairs. That one chair is what Socrates calls the idea of the chair or the form of the chair. Remember, those two words, idea and form, are synonyms. The next move Socrates makes is even more shocking than the fact that he is revisiting the theme of poetry. He says, there is a God, and God produced the ideas. He uses as his example the idea of the couch. Very ordinary, lowly object. I'm referring here to 597b. Now, this truly has given scholars fits because it doesn't seem to cohere with so much else that we've heard Plato say about his theory of ideas. Nowhere else in the Republic has he mentioned some sort of creative God who is able to make the ideas, make the forms. In fact, that notion of a creative God actually contradicts some of the things he says about the forms in Book 6 and Book 7, because one important feature of the forms is that they are permanent or eternal. They do not come into being. However, if here in Book 10 we're told that God makes the ideas, then they do come into being and they're not eternal. This is a problem, a real problem, and I'll try to address it, give you some suggestion about how to think about it at the very end of this lecture. So, first step, God makes the idea of the couch. Second step, a carpenter who imitates the idea of the couch builds a couch using wood. He builds a particular couch. Third step, a painter imitates the couch that the carpenter built and draws a painting. The key word in this discussion is imitation. Again, a very broad word. It means any form of artistic representation. From this metaphysical scheme, and the word metaphysical comes very close to a word we've discussed, the word ontological. A metaphysics is a conception of reality. So a metaphysical scheme is a scheme about reality. From this metaphysical scheme, God makes the idea of the couch, carpenter builds the couch, painter imitates the carpenter's couch. Socrates concludes, and now I'm referring to 598b, that imitation is very far from the truth. It's two big steps removed from the truth. The truth is found, of course, in the forms, in the ideas. The painter doesn't even have access to them. The painter's access to the form is mediated by the carpenter's couch. That's what the painter paints. Socrates expresses this by saying at 599a that imitation in general, again, artistic representation, is third from what is, third from being, and therefore is intrinsically deficient. This is the metaphysical critique of poetry, poetry understood in this very broad sense to embrace close to all forms of artistic making. Second argument that Socrates offers against poetry, and this one is more focused on poetry a bit more narrowly construed as literature, is a psychological critique. Let's use drama as our example. I believe it is what Socrates has in mind here. When you go to the theater, and the Greeks loved the theater, we find on stage imitations of real people. They're in costume, they're play acting, they are in the Greek theater wearing masks. And we get involved in the events that take place on stage. These are not real events. These, of course, are artistic representations. These artistic representations require images. And these artistic representations generate tremendous emotional reaction in the audience. This is, of course, the heart and soul of drama. When we go to the theater, for example, we might see Sophocles' great play, Oedipus the King. We see a very good man, Oedipus, suffering terribly. He has inadvertently killed his father, married his mother through no real fault of his own. He suffers an extraordinary fate. The audience feels pity. The audience feels fear. The audience is caught up in this grand imitation, in these beautiful words, in the images that are on stage. All of this, which might sound pretty good to some people, is exactly what Socrates here is criticizing about poetry. The way he puts it is that poetry, and again, let's use drama as our example, it nourishes the irrational part of the soul. And what's that irrational part of the soul? Our desires, our emotions. It's not our reason. If we didn't have emotional reactions in the theater, the play we were watching, we would say, is not a good play. Remember Socrates' model of a just human being, especially in Book 4. You recall that the soul is always described as having three parts, reason, spirit, and desire. Spirit is very much an emotion. And the just human being, says Socrates, is harmonious. Reason controls desire. Spirit is the ally of reason in the control of desire. Such a human being, a good human being, according to Socrates' argument, would be very calm, very rational, very collected, exactly not like the person we see on stage. The very essence, I think, of drama is conflict. If there were no conflict that the character faced, the play simply wouldn't be interesting. But it's exactly conflict that Socrates has been trying to eliminate for the entirety of the Republic. First and foremost, in his constructed city, he was trying to eliminate conflict between citizens. And then, when we made the transfer into the individual soul, he is trying to eliminate internal conflict. Unlike a person who is at war with himself because he can't control his own desires, the Socratic model is one of the absence of conflict, of harmony. This is, yet again, the opposite of what we see in Greek tragedy. And that's why Socrates, here in Book 10, suggests, let's get rid of it. It's bad. It nourishes, it supports, it reinforces what's not the best part of us, what is, in fact, the lowest part of us. This same sort of critique would apply, and Socrates makes this point explicit at 606c, to comedy. Comedy in the 5th century, in the 4th century in ancient Greece, was not so different from our own versions of comedy. In any comedy that we would watch today, or an ancient Greek would watch, there'd be plenty of dirty jokes, jokes about the body. The body tends to be a very funny subject when it's displayed on stage. What happens when we go to the theater to watch a comedy, says Socrates, is that we laugh at things we would be ashamed of laughing at if we were at home alone. We laugh at things that we would never even make public in private. So comedy, Socrates is arguing here in Book 10, brings out the worst in us. And therefore, he concludes, 605b, we should not admit, not allow poets into our city. A very, very radical condemnation of poetry. The phrase Socrates uses to summarize this line of thought is found at 607b. He describes an old quarrel between philosophy and poetry. The two are at war with each other, and we have had some suggestions as to why this is the case. The philosopher, and of course it's the philosopher who rules in Socrates' constructed city, the philosopher is the supremely rational human being whose desires are at service of reason. The philosopher is a soul utterly dominated by reason. Going to the theater, whether it's tragedy or comedy, threatens to disrupt that nice pattern of harmony. Let me now offer you some speculations. And here, as I've tried to do throughout this course, I must identify these as my own interpretations. This is a very mysterious chapter in Plato's Republic, Book 10, for the reasons I've already mentioned to you. And a commentator must do some speculating. There's no way out. So I will offer you some suggestions and ask you to think about them critically and perhaps even try to come up with your own. Here's the first question. Why is this critique of poetry found in Book 10 so much more severe than the censorship found in Books 2 and 3? Censorship is bad enough, but at least it allows some form of poetry to exist in the city. Book 10, there is none. Well, let me suggest an idea that comes very close to being paradoxical. I think Socrates is so critical of poetry in Book 10 because he respects it so much. You might think of a relationship any one of us has to an opponent. Think, for example, if you're an athlete. If you're an athlete, you develop a very complicated relationship to your opponent, especially if you have an opponent who really challenges you. If you're a tennis player and you're much, much better than your opponent, you can defeat her easily. That's not a very interesting game. If, by contrast, your opponent is as good as you are, or perhaps even a little better, it's a terrific match. Maybe you win, maybe you lose, but at the end of the day, you know you've been pushed so hard by your opponent, and as a result, you have a respect and an affection even for your opponent, even though you just spent such a grueling couple of hours trying to defeat her. I would suggest that something like this is going on in Socrates' relationship to poetry. It is his opponent. He is critical of it. But at the same time, he acknowledges its immense power, its immense role that it plays in human culture. Another way to put this point is that he acknowledges that poetry is a fundamental human option. It's a fundamental alternative to philosophy, and it can't simply be refuted. It won't disappear. No one is going to read the arguments in Book 10 of the Republic and then say, okay, I'll never write any more poetry. I won't go to any more plays. That sort of artistic production has such a pull on us, we'll never let it go. I think Plato understands this very well. Now, let me suggest you read 607c with some care, because it's another one of these rather surprising lines that we so often find in the Republic. He says that if there could be an argument that a poet could make to defend his poetry, then in fact we would be delighted to receive it into the city. I would describe that line as a door opener. It opens the door to the possibility of what I would describe as a philosophical form of poetry. If a kind of poetry could emerge which could explain itself, justify itself, articulate itself philosophically, then it would be acceptable in the very city which just a few lines earlier had banished the poets. Let me make a radical suggestion, one that you should take with a grain of salt. I would suggest that the Platonic dialogues themselves, the Republic in particular, is exactly this, a philosophical form of poetry. Let's just take a step back and think about the Republic in rather commonsensical terms. What do we discover? Well, we discover, first of all, it's a lot like a drama. There are plenty of characters, and the author of this drama, Plato, imitates them. When you're reading Book One, you meet this old man, Cephalus, and then you meet this younger man, Polemarchus, and then we meet this extremely hot-headed man, Thrasymachus. These are all very lifelike characters, and you, as a reader, are caught up in the drama of Socrates trying to refute them. Well, this is very peculiar, because what we're discovering is that Plato himself violates his own strictures against poetry in the Republic itself. I think he's playing a little trick on us the readers. He's criticizing poetry, but he's actually writing a poem. Again, remember, poem is a much broader word than we typically take it to be. He's writing a poem in which one of the characters, Socrates, criticizes poetry. Let me give another example of how Plato plays this trick on us. And here I'll go back a little bit to Book Two. If you recall, the storylines of all literature are severely censored in Book Two and in Book Three. And one of the prohibitions that Socrates insists upon is that we're not going to have stories in which just men are unhappy and unjust men are happy. That's a very dangerous story because we would use it to discourage people from being just. If we tell stories in which just people come to bad endings, then we might have a deleterious effect on our citizens. That was the rationale in Book Two. But let's never forget the story, and that is what it is, that actually sparks the entire Republic. And that's the story Glaucon tells about the ring of Gyges. And here we have a man who steals a ring, uses it to become invisible, sleeps with the queen, kills the king. He is not a just man, and he seems to flourish. Now, that's a story that Glaucon tells in order to provoke Socrates to refute it. Nonetheless, Glaucon tells a story which would itself be prohibited in the city that Socrates constructs. Another example of the sort of trick I think Plato is playing on us. He is trying to show us implicitly that while, yes, poetry is to be criticized, at the same time, it's not actually to be completely banished. It's actually present in the Republic itself. In this regard, let me make a comparison between Socrates' attitude towards poetry and his attitude towards sophistry. Remember, Thrasymachus is a sophist. He is a relativist. He practices the art of rhetoric. In many dialogues, Socrates draws a comparison between the sophist and the poet. Recall that the relativist denies that there is any absolute truth and instead insists that all truth, all values are relative to a particular context or social group. In this country, freedom of speech is counted to be a good thing. In that country, it's counted to be a bad thing. Freedom of speech is neither good nor bad. It depends who holds the view. Rhetoric plays such an important role in the relativistic world of the sophist because it's by means of rhetoric that any given value, any given truth comes into being. If I can manage to persuade the citizens of my city to believe that freedom of speech is a good thing, then freedom of speech will be counted as a good thing. It's not absolutely good. It's not objectively good. It's good in my city. Why is it good? Because I made it good. I constructed a view and I persuaded other people to buy into my view. I use the word make deliberately to draw the connection between sophistry and poetry. Both of them imply that human beings don't see the truth, they make the truth. Or more accurately, they make lots and lots and lots of truths. I would suggest that Plato has a very similar attitude to sophistry and to poetry. He's very critical of both. Neither is as good as philosophy, but he understands that both are extremely powerful opponents. They are both representative of fundamental human options, and Plato understands very well that they cannot simply disappear. So, when it comes to sophistry, we certainly have learned that Socrates is not averse to using rhetoric. He borrows the tricks that the sophist himself would use, and so he defeats Thrasymachus in Book 1. And we, of course, know that Socrates is really not averse to using the tools of the poet. Repeatedly, we've seen him tell stories. We've seen him construct images. I suggested in earlier lectures that Books 8 and 9 really constitute the story of regime change. Not a logical argument, not a historical analysis, but a story. So Socrates himself, while criticizing both of his opponents, nonetheless respects both very highly. I'm finally able to make a very brief suggestion about why Socrates introduces what is, in fact, a bizarre idea given the rest of the Republic, and that is that there is a creative God who creates the forms. Perhaps you can guess what my suggestion is. What he is underlining is the worldview, the view that both the sophists and the poets hold. It's the view that reality is made. Reality is not seen. Seeing is what the philosopher does. The philosopher sees the truth. The sophist makes up persuasive arguments. The poet makes up stories. The enormous emphasis on making in this section, I think, is encapsulated with this otherwise bizarre idea that God himself is created, an idea we do not find anywhere else in the Republic.
Lecture 22, Book 10, The Myth of Ur.
At the end of the last lecture, I described Plato as something of a trickster. And I want to elaborate a little bit on what I mean by that. I certainly don't mean he's engaged in fun and games and just performing a sleight of hand in order to amuse us. Far from it. I think what Plato is so good at is throwing a monkey wrench into our expectations. In Book 10, we've seen him criticize poetry, but then I suggested to you that, in fact, much of the Republic itself should be construed as a poem, as a story in which characters are imitated, and in fact, therefore, the Republic violates its own stricture. We will see this pattern dramatically in the last chapter of the Republic, the very last section. Immediately after having launched into this extended criticism of poetry, which we discussed in the last lecture, what does Socrates do? I'm sure you can guess. He tells a story. He tells a myth. It's the myth of Ur. This is a myth which, as we'll see, is an afterworld myth about what happens to us after we die. This is a myth, by the way, which will return us full circle to the very beginning of the Republic. You recall it opens with Cephalus. Cephalus is an old man, but he is not, he says, afraid to die because he believes he's led a just life and therefore won't be punished in the next world. Here at the very end of Book 10, through the myth of Ur, Socrates' own poetic creation, we return to that same theme. What I mean by a trick, in other words, is really a provocation to thought. Again, we're not just being played with, we readers. We're being forced to think hard. The Republic doesn't give its secrets easily. We, the readers, have to work hard. Is Plato critical of poetry or is he not? We know good reasons for both answers. And it's exactly that debate that goes on inside our own minds as we're reading that I think Plato very deliberately is trying to generate. He wants us to be active readers. He wants us to think. The last thing he wants us to do is simply sit passively and write notes and say, well, here's what Socrates says. It must be true. No, far from it. It's a carefully designed dialogue whose intention is to generate a philosophical response in the reader. So let's move to the myth of Ur. There's actually a prelude to it. It occurs in line 608D. to 611a, and this part is not a myth, but an argument. And here Socrates argues that the soul is immortal. Let me outline the steps of the argument for you, and then we can reflect upon it. Socrates begins by saying, for every object, there is a good and a bad thing that relates to it. Illustrate it easily with an example. For the body, sickness is bad and health is good. That's the example. Every object has its own bad, its own good. Sickness will destroy the body. Next, Socrates asks a question. What if there were an object whose bad, the bad thing related specifically to it, did not and could not destroy its object? This thing would then become indestructible. It would become immortal. Now let's focus on the soul. What is the bad for a soul? Well, we've spent a great amount of time in the Republic trying to prove that the bad is injustice. But injustice, while it certainly makes a soul worse, doesn't destroy a soul. And we have, unfortunately, a vast amount of evidence to demonstrate that. There are plenty of unjust people running around the world. They are damaged by being unjust. Their souls are damaged, but they're still there. They're still alive and kicking. Very often they occupy positions of political power. What we've discovered, in short, is a thing, namely the soul, whose bad doesn't destroy it, and therefore, Socrates concludes, the soul is immortal. As always, I urge you to analyze this argument on your own. You should see if I did a good job in my own analysis. I would suggest that this is not, at least by my reading, a terribly convincing argument. It's an interesting argument, but I personally am not convinced that it irrefutably demonstrates that the soul is immortal. What it does do, however, is set up Socrates' next move. And I've already mentioned what that is. Socrates will next tell a story about the afterworld, what happens to the soul after death. I count that argument that we've just outlined to be a kind of prelude to what's really interesting at the end of Book 10, and that is the myth itself, the myth of Ur. The myth takes place between lines 614b and 621d. We are now rapidly approaching the very end of Plato's Republic. Who was Er? He was a warrior who was killed in battle, but he was allowed to come back to life to report what it was that he had seen in the afterworld. A fabulous story, to say the least. Let me try to sketch for you, and it's not a bad exercise to try to draw this yourself so that you can visualize it, the geography of the afterworld. It's very clearly structured. For someone who apparently hates poetry as much as Plato seems to, this myth is beautifully detailed. When a soul dies, it's brought down to what Socrates calls at 614c, the demonic place. It's a very forbidding title. It means the place of the spirits, the departed, the dead. In this place, which, as you'll see as we go further in the story, is probably best imagined as a very crowded railway station or an airport. There's lots and lots of souls milling about. In this place, souls are judged. If they were unjust, they're going to be punished. And they go down, imagine it to be a tunnel that is at their left. In all of Greek thinking, left is always bad and right is good. So the bad people go down and to the left. And at that point, they embark upon 1,000 years of punishment, 1,000 years of pain, in retribution for the injustice they committed while alive. If the departed is good and had a good, just life while on earth, they are rewarded by going up and to the right. And at that point, they go on another 1,000-year voyage, and this one is pleasurable. It's blissful. After the 1,000 years, they come back. The bad people are coming up, and now they've made it to the right, and they enter what I'm describing as a waiting room, re-enter it, because this is where they started, and the good people who have gone up and to the right, make their full circle and come back down into the demonic place. There's only one exception to this rule. It's extremely important. It's the key to my own interpretation of this myth, and that's the tyrant. The tyrant about whom we read so much in Book 9, the tyrant who is so severely criticized by Socrates, who is said to lead a life that's precisely 729 times worse than the life of the just man. The tyrant, naturally, goes down to the left for the 1,000 years of pain, but is not allowed to come back up into the demonic place, into the waiting room. There are big monsters there who keep the tyrant down. And that's where the tyrant stays for eternity. In other words, this is eternal damnation. Tyrants are described as incurable. They're so bad, they'll always be bad. By contrast, a run-of-the-mill bad person, after having gone through the 1,000 years of painful punishment, is allowed to return. Presumably, this person, as we'll see, has been cured. What happens next after these 1,000-year journeys? The souls are taken on a tour. I can imagine them being put on a bus. That's, of course, a silly anachronism, but they are taken on a tour, and what they see is miraculous. They see the cosmos itself. They see the 8 circular orbits of the heavenly bodies. They hear the harmony of the spheres. They see in some the geometric beauty of the whole universe, the whole cosmos. They see the world in its complete intelligibility. It's a glorious vision. What happens next? After going on their tour, these souls have to make a choice. We're headed towards the real crux of the myth. There's a lottery, and the lottery determines the order of selection that each soul will have. And what is it that they're selecting? They're selecting the next life they will lead. This is, obviously enough now, a reincarnation myth. So these souls, having undergone 1,000 years of either punishment or pleasure, after having gone on a tour of the cosmos, make a choice. Socrates uses very dramatic language to describe this choice at 6:18c. He says, "Here is the whole risk for a human being." And what I think he means by this is that everything matters here. What matters for us and what matters for these departed souls is what kind of life they will choose. I would suggest, and I have suggested several times, this is the main theme of Plato's Republic. Yes, it's very much about politics, of course, but at the same time, its fundamental question is exactly the question faced at 6:18c. What sort of life will you choose? The person who wins the lottery gets to pick first. This person, it turns out, had lived a very decent life. He was not, however, a philosopher. He was, let's call him, an ordinary good citizen, not a very thoughtful person. Having won the lottery, he's very eager to pick first. What life does he pick? Catastrophic choice. He picks the life of a tyrant. The tyrant always seems so attractive because, after all, the tyrant has such great power. The tyrant seems to get exactly what he wants. He seems to be able to give orders to everybody. Naturally, he becomes attractive, especially to this first lottery winner who had lived a non-philosophical life. The point that Socrates makes here is very interesting. What he describes is what he calls an exchange, and I'm referring to 6:19d, an exchange of evils and goods for most of the souls. And here's what I think he means. Let's recall the mechanics of the myth. If you were a decent person, like the guy who won the lottery, you were rewarded with 1,000 years of pleasure. If you were a bad person, you were punished with 1,000 years of pain. But what happened to this guy who was rewarded with 1,000 years of pleasure? Well, he seems to have been stupefied by the 1,000 years of pleasure. It made him soft. It made him thoughtless. It seemingly caused him to make this catastrophic choice of a next life. By contrast, somebody who is bad, having gone through so much punishment, will be so afraid, so cautious, so concerned about not making a bad choice that it's likely, Socrates suggests, they'll make a good choice the second time around. This is what he means at 6:19d by an exchange. Those who had good lives end up with bad lives, and vice versa. Now, the man who picked first and picked the life of a tyrant has done something whose consequences are literally infinite. And just remind you of this feature of the myth, which I drew your attention to earlier. The tyrant is counted as someone incurable and is not allowed back up after the 1,000 years of punishment. The tyrant doesn't get another chance. This otherwise pretty decent human being who made the catastrophic choice of the life of a tyrant has, in effect, sentenced himself to eternal damnation. We'll reflect on this point a little further in a couple of minutes. Let's take a look, though, at one of the most interesting characters who does make what seems